And children, you may now go over with Miss Heather and Miss Kara. We are asking the kids still wear masks while they're in the kids section. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane. Good morning, everyone. That was really sad. Good morning, everyone. Morning. Thank you. Thank you. Since it's Father's Day and it's a joyous day all around, especially for us dads, I thought I'd share a message from one of the most joyous books of the Bible, Job. That's what we get when we adhere to the lectionary readings, isn't it? There were a couple options. For those of you who are unaware of how the lectionary readings work, there's probably a verse or a section from the Old Testament, then there's a section from the prophets, and there's a section from the Gospels, and then there's a section from the New Testament. And so I could pick from any of those, or I could pick just one, or I could pick all of them. And I decided to pick Job because at the beginning of the week when I started preparing for this sermon, I was a little melancholy. It was Monday, and so here we are. It is what it is. Some of you know that I have a real passion, maybe not a passion, but a real hobby for anything having to do with aviation. I love airplanes. I think I've passed this on to my son Ruben, who's 2.5. Anytime something flies by, anytime a helicopter is heard, we both look up at the sky and we try to figure out what it is and maybe where it's going. And I have an app on my phone that allows me to, virtual reality, VR. I look at you, Jonathan, because you're the whiz on this stuff. Well, your son is, anyway. But you can, like, take a picture of the plane, and it will tell you where it took off and where it's going. It's just so cool, and I don't know why flying fascinates me. I guess it's because it defies so many of the laws of, like, physics that we grew up with and understand as humans that are tied to the ground. I really loved flying prior to starting to travel for business, and though I don't travel for business much anymore, for about 3.5-4 years I traveled about 80 nights a year. And once you spend that many days in an airplane on end, it just becomes not fun anymore. But one of the things that you stop thinking about when you're traveling so frequently is the dangers associated with flying. I work with somebody who is terrified of flying. He chooses not to do it if it's a possibility. If he can drive it to the destination, if he can take a train, he does so. And, you know, it's just a thing. People are fearful of flying. And according to anxieties.com, which is a trusted resource on all things flying, I'm just kidding. Don't look at anxieties.com like I did. It actually tries to make you feel safe. Flying is about 20 times more safer than driving a car. And you've heard the stats before. Anytime you have somebody who's afraid of flying, you have somebody who's trying to comfort that person by saying, no, it's so much safer than what you do on a daily basis. And there's been studies done on this. Dr. Arnold Barnett of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, has done extensive research into commercial flight safety. He studied air travel for 19 years, from 1975 to 1994, and found that the death risk per flight was about 1 in 7 million. And 1 in 7 million. With that statistic, you can rework the math a little bit and discover that you or I could take a flight every day of our lives for the next 19,000 years and wouldn't succumb to death by aviation until we reach 19,000 year mark. So since none of us are going to get there, we have a pretty good chance of not perishing via air travel. But that doesn't mean that plane wrecks don't happen, of course. And we know anytime a plane wreck happens because it's blasted all over the news. We know exactly what happened, exactly how many people were on board, exactly the nationalities of those people, where the plane was going, where it took off from, what was the reason. You know, we have those black boxes in the cockpit that record all of the flight data. And we're just obsessed with figuring out what went wrong. I want to focus on one plane wreck in particular, and I'm sorry that this is such a downer, but we're talking about Job here, folks, so bear with me. We'll get somewhere else by the end of this. On March 8, 2014, and if I ask you to remember what happened on that day, unless you had family members involved in this or are a savant of some sort. You probably don't remember exactly what happened, but on March 8th, 2014, a Boeing 777. Many of you have probably flown on a Boeing 777 if you've gone anywhere internationally. It's about 210 feet long. It has a wingspan of about 212 feet. It's massive. Can hold up to 270 people. It's one of these things, and the skunk just went again. I apologize if you smell that. One of these 777s took off from Kuala Lumpur Airport in Malaysia en route to Beijing, and it had 239 people on board. And I can see some of you shaking your heads. You know exactly what happened here. The plane with 249 people on board took off, and it was traceable by air traffic control for around 38 minutes, which typically is a really good thing because you want the plane to be traceable by air traffic control for the duration of the flight. However, after 38 minutes, MH370, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, disappeared. It was discovered a little later that military radar, and you know, radar that is more sophisticated than basic air traffic control, was able to track the plane for an additional hour, then it too disappeared from military radar. The unique thing about MH370 in comparison to other plane crashes that are in the news is that we just don't know what happened. We don't know what happened. It's been 7 years. There's been bits and pieces of the plane that have washed up on the shores of East Africa and elsewhere. But generally speaking, we just don't know what happens. And that stuff drives us nuts, doesn't it? As humans who have evolved into people that want to be all-knowing, we are passionate about doing research, some of us more so than others. But we just don't know what happened, and that kills us. What happened after MH370 disappeared became the most expensive search and probably not rescue mission in the history of the world. We had governments, militaries, foundations spending billions of dollars trying to figure out where MH370 went and what happened. We don't know. It was on the news every day, it seemed like, for weeks at a time. And one of the things that Jane mentioned before I came up here is, what do I do for work? Well, I work in distribution. It's not exciting or fun or anything, but what I am passionate about is communication. That's what I studied in college. I'm passionate about public relations, specifically crisis public relations. So when bad things happen, how do people talk about it publicly? And so I imagine being in the PR office of Malaysian Airlines in March and April and May and June of 2014, and we're just trying to give answers to people, but no, we don't have them. Families are coming to us crying, screaming, what happened to my sister? What happened to my dad? We don't know. And then just 4 months later, another Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 crashes. And we know a little bit more about why this one happened. It was shot down over the border of Ukraine and Russia and probably had something to do with the conflict that was going on in that area at the time. But what are the chances? Malaysian Airlines, another aircraft under that umbrella with the same tail wing, another Boeing 777 in the same 3 or 4 month time period, it's just gone. And again, the PR people at Malaysian Airlines probably have to be dumbfounded. I know I would be. We don't know why it happened. To this day, we don't really know who shot the plane down because nobody's owned up to it. We have theories. But again, it kills us to not know what happened. And that brings us to today's lectionary reading from Job. And so I'm going to kind of gloss over the first 37 chapters of Job, which sounds like super easy, right? And then we'll get to where we're talking about today. But you know the story of Job. It opens up with the description of Job as this wonderful man, has done no wrong, has a great family, great life, great farm. And then we are kind of transitioned into the heavens, where God is meeting with his angels. And one angel in particular, called the Satan, spelled the same way as Satan, is Satan. The Satan, also known as the accuser, says to God, I think good people only do good things because they want your blessing. And if they didn't have that carrot dangling in front of them, they would just do whatever they want. They wouldn't praise you. They wouldn't worship you. And God says, okay, well, take my man Job, for example. Upright, good standing man in the community, loves his family. He worships me. Do what you want with him, and we'll test that theory. So over the next 37 chapters, Job loses everything. He loses his wife, his family, his kids, his farm, his health. And in his unknowing, in his inability to understand the circumstances, he has some friends over. And we all know that when we're in situations where we don't have answers, whether it's a cancer diagnosis or the unexpected death of a family member or close friend, friends can either help or hurt, right? Job's friends don't exactly help him. Job starts this litigation. He puts God on trial. God, why did you do this to me? It's been taught to me that when I do good works, you return good favors. If I don't do good works, if I sin, you give me the wrath I deserve. But I didn't do anything wrong. So why are you treating me like this? And Job's friends say, well, you obviously did something wrong. Maybe you just don't remember it. But our God is a just God. He wouldn't treat you this way if you were actually a good person. This goes on, as I say, for 37 chapters, back and forth. Job crying out to God in anger and in not understanding. And Job's friends saying, yeah, but, I mean, it's your fault at the end of the day, really. And finally, after some time, God appears to Job. And he says this from Job 38. And if you have your Bibles, you can open them up. Job 38, I'll be reading from verses 1 through 13. My translation might be a little different than yours. But then the Lord appeared in front of Job out of a whirlwind and said this, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. That's my favorite part of this. God said, man up, dude. Gird up your loins. Put your big boy britches on. I will question you and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have an understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all heavenly beings shouted for joy? Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb, when I made the clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bonds for it and set bars and doors, and then said, thus far shall you come and no further, and here shall you your proud waves be stopped. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, to know when the sun should come up, so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? I could go on and read from chapter 38 until the end of the book, and it's just the same imagery. It's a poem. And it's kind of making Job feel like, what's going on? Can you imagine if you're in the PR office of Malaysian Airlines in July 2014, your planes were carrying about 500 people when they crashed, and you have to answer to the families of these folks. And instead of saying, we're sorry, we don't know what happened, you come out and start speaking in poems about how great you are and how great a company Malaysian Airlines is. We've seen this in the news media, people just talking, and they put that public relations spin on things, and it just doesn't make sense, and it doesn't answer questions. And what does it do to us? It makes us mad, right? We get mad because we're not getting the answer we wanted. This sermon is called Unresolved because I'm not going to resolve it. I'm sorry. There's no answers here. And like the PR office of Malaysian Airlines, I don't have anything to resolve. I don't get it. I can only imagine Job after yelling at God, probably so much so that he lost his voice. He has his friends come over. His friends aren't helpful. That's great. God comes and says, don't you know how great I am? Put your big boy pants on, Job. What do we do in those situations? what do we do after the cancer diagnosis? You know, one of the things that's crazy about the medical, the healthcare system in the United States is that, you know, perhaps it really tugs on our hope of knowing, right? Perhaps you feel a lump in your breast and you schedule a doctor's appointment. You have to wait for the doctor's appointment. And then you go to the doctor's and the doctor's like, well, maybe we should have a scan and see what's going on. And then you have to wait for the scan. And you just want to know. And at some point, you don't even care or not if you have cancer. You just want to know. So you go in and have the scan, and then you wait a week and go back to have it read, and they tell you the result. Job doesn't know. One of the things that I think we can identify about with Job is that we just want simplification. That's what research is all about. If we could just explain, I saw John Colazzi talking about string theory. If we could just explain why things are the way they are, well, maybe that would have implications for other things. But even after crying out to God again and again and again, God doesn't give us an answer. What does God do? He paints a picture of how glorious, how vast he is. He reminds us that he created everything. He knows when the sun should come up in the morning. He goes in later on in the book about the eating habits of mountain goats. He knows that. Job doesn't. We don't. We don't know the science behind it. We could probably research, but we'd only understand up to a certain point, right? And it's almost like God is trying to tell us, like, it's okay that you don't know. Let me talk about how great I am so you're reminded of the fact that you're not alone in this world. I have a 2-year-old. I know that a lot of you have either had 2-year-olds or have 2-year-olds right now, and you know the tantrums. Oh my gosh, the tantrums. I can't even begin to explain how angry I get when the tantrums come. And if we equate my son Reuben to Job at this instance, you know, a few weekends ago he had the tantrum of the century. I didn't know what was wrong, but he had something to say, and he just couldn't express it, and so he screamed until he lost his voice. He thrashed until he bit his lip. There was blood everywhere. And at that point, I'm trying to explain to him, no, we need to go to bed. This is good for you. We'll have energy in the morning. And then I get emotional while I'm trying to tell him this, because I just know he's never going to get it, at least not now. And sometimes I like to think of God as the father in that situation. If God is talking to Job and God becomes emotional, Job, you just don't get it. But let me talk about what I do for you and what I've done for this earth. Let me talk about how big and vast I am. And sometimes when the tantrum happens, the only thing that helps is a snuggle, you know? And from Reuben's perspective, that must mean a relinquishing of an attempt to understand. Maybe he said, I'm not going to get it this time, but at least I can rest knowing that I have a father who cares for me. I think that's what God is for us. And so I'm not here to give you answers as to what you can do in those times of unknowing. But maybe it's a little reframing that we can do. Maybe it's just relaxing in the unknown, being comfortable in the unresolved, because we have a God that's greater than us. I'm going to end this morning by reading a children's book that was recommended to us, and we just got it from Amazon in time. Thanks be to God that Amazon delivers in 2 days and not 4, like the USPS. That's a joke. You can laugh. But this book just came out recently. It's called What is God Like? And it's going to be so fun to read this to our children, because it approaches something that I don't know the answer to in a child's way. It was written by Rachel Held Evans and Matthew Paul Turner. Rachel Held Evans, of course, has written many books. Unfortunately, her life was cut short due to illness when her kids were only 3 years and 1 year old. But she was in the process of writing these kids' books when she passed. And so this one just came out. And I'm just going to read the beginning of it, because it'll help us get into that mindset that maybe we just have to think like children when it comes to viewing God in hard times. Here are the pictures. I'm going to do my best to show you. What is God like? That's a very big question, one that people from places all around the world have wondered about since the beginning of time. And while nobody has seen all of God, because God is far too big for any of us to fully see, we can know what God is like. God is like an eagle, sharp-eyed and swift, with wings so wide you can play under their shadows. God is like a river, constant and life-giving. When you grow near God, you'll sprout up as strong as a tree. God is like the stars, forever present and bright. Even when they feel far away, you can always look up and see them winking at you. God is like a shepherd, brave and good, a protector who loves her sheep so much that she watches over them and knows each one of them by heart. God is like a fort. This is my favorite. Forts are awesome. Now that Reuben's getting into forts, it's super fun to like build them and hide in them. And eventually he like gets bored with it after like 10 minutes. But forts are cool. And it reminds me of how cool it was to build a fort. God is like a fort, strong and secure, with walls that are mighty and safe. Inside there are hidden places to hold you when you're scared or need a quiet place to rest. And it goes on and on. But it's a beautiful way to think about God from a child's perspective. And that's what I want to encourage you to do today, when we're in that space of unknowing. When we don't know and when we crave answers, maybe we don't need answers. Maybe we just need to relax in knowing that God holds us. I'm going to close in prayer, and the worship team can come back up at this time. As you go on this week, just think, there's some questions in your bulletin, and I don't think I have one in front of me, but in what times of your life have you felt like you don't have any answers, but you need them? And in those times, what has helped you remember that God is all-knowing? And they're simple questions, but they're actually pretty deep, so take some time to think about it. View God as a child, looking up to our Father. God, we thank you for the breeze this morning, because otherwise the skunk would have smoked everybody out. God, thank you for your creation and the warmth. Simple reminders that remind us that you are all-knowing, that you are the creator, and that it's okay if we don't understand why things work the way they do. Lord, comfort us in the spaces we exist in, regardless of whether they're joyous or sad, regardless of whether we have no questions, we're feeling it, or if we have all the questions and none of them are being answered. We know you, O God, have the power to live within us and guide our steps and comfort us. And we ask that you do that this week. We seek to understand you. We seek to attempt to define you. But at the end of the day, we just thank you for who you are. Amen.